Today on the 21st show, it's been said Americans are facing an epidemic of loneliness. We'll talk about why so many of us are feeling it and what we can do about it. We'll also talk about how having a robust social network can make a difference for adults trying to stay healthy later in life.
A lot of people expand their networks over time, get involved with their children, get involved in the community, get involved in hobbies. And I think that that is a really important thing that we need to continue to encourage in our society.
I'm Brian Mackey. That's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. At our core, humans are social creatures. It's being together that's helped us not just survive as a species, but thrive. Yet so many of us struggle to stay connected. A recent survey from the American Psychological Association estimates half of U.S. adults say they lack companionship or are isolated from others, at least some of the time. That was part of an annual APA report called Stress in America, and last year its subtitle was A Crisis of Connection. That takes its toll, both on our brains and our bodies. Later in the hour, we'll talk about loneliness and some of the things we can do about it. But first today, what difference does connection make for a population whose health is especially vulnerable, namely older adults? And what can seniors do to expand their social networks? We talked about all this in December of last year with Lizette Piedra. She's a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the School of Social Work, as well as Latina and Latino Studies. Also with us was Emily Harmon, a family life educator for the University of Illinois Extension in Champaign. She works with older adults on making good life choices for healthy living and aging. Again, this conversation's on tape. Because of that, we cannot take your calls live today, but you can share your thoughts by sending us an email. The address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Emily, I'm going to start with you. Basic question. What does healthy aging look like?
I think that's a very individual question. It greatly depends on the person, really. What healthy aging looks like for one person may be different for another. But really, I think generally we can say it's just making those healthy lifestyle choices. And it doesn't have to be running a 5K every year or whatever. It could simply just think about eating good, eating some good nutritious foods, and engaging in physical activity, engaging your mind, trying to challenge your mind with different things, whether it be if you're used to sewing and you're really good at it, try crocheting, just something different to engage your brain in a different way. So just generally just making good lifestyle choices. And it's okay to slip up every once in a while.
Yeah. good point. How does mental health relate to physical health?
Oh, absolutely. I was just talking about it this past week. If you have a fixed mindset, and if a fixed mindset is kind of where it's that negative self-talk, where you're just like, I can't do this. And a positive mindset or an open mindset is more like, I can do this, or I can learn how to do this. So just trying to engage in more of an open mindset instead of that fixed mindset can open the doors for a lot of different things. And it can help with your self-esteem as well. Like I was saying, like if you're trying to engage in more physical activity, for example, you don't have to do the 5K. That's not your end goal. It could be simply just going outside and walking to the next block, or just walking to your mailbox, or when it's cold outside like it is today, just taking a lap around the house or around wherever you're living, just setting those goals that are achievable so it can help your self-esteem and that mental health as well.
All right, Lizette Piedra, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Why does being social matter as much in terms of people getting older as a part of healthy aging?
Well, you can think of social connection as a real core pillar of healthy aging. I mean, we know that in order to age healthy, you need to have good nutrition, you need to be physically active, you need to sleep well. These are all things that contribute to health over the life course. But social connection has emerged as a huge pillar in that. We know that if a person is lonely, if they're socially isolated, their chances of increases to feeling lonely. It raises the risk of depression, cognitive decline, dysfunctional loss, so higher risk of mortality, and that connection is vulnerable because as people age, their social network is likely to decline or constrict due to things like retirement, their health changes. They may be having caregiving responsibilities. And so the likelihood of your connections, you know, constraining as you get older increases. But there's also a lot of, if you make a conscious effort to stay connected, there's really a lot of benefits that people can get by staying socially connected.
Your research looks at different kinds of social networks that older people have. You have enriched groups and restricted groups. Walk us through that.
Well, when we did our study, I did it with my darling colleague, James Ivanuk, over at NORC at the University of Chicago. And we looked at a huge data set, and we came down to having three network types. One is an enriched one, which is very large, very diverse. Another one is very focused. It's a smaller network. Size-wise, but people seem to be very close to one another. And then the restricted one is a very limited, there's a high incidence of loneliness in this network, poor social resources. And what we found, we tracked to see how did people's networks shift over time, whether did they shift, how did they shift. And what we found is that if someone is in a focused network, that as they got older, or as time went on, they were more likely to shift into an enriched network, which tended to have the lowest rates of loneliness, highest rates of marriage, and just more diverse networks. But that if people landed in a restricted group, they were more likely to get stuck there. They would stay in the restricted group. But what we found was most interesting was that you could move your network, and that a lot of people tended to move into more enriched networks as they aged, which we see as a real silver lining to people. We like to think that older adults become more lonely over time. It's not necessarily true. A lot of people expand their networks over time, get involved with their children, get involved in the community, get involved in hobbies. And I think that is a really important thing that we need to continue to encourage in our society.
Emily Harmon, family life educator at the U of I Extension. What are some of the barriers that older people face in being more involved with their community?
I think Lizette kind of mentioned it, but as you get older, as we all know, because we are all aging, whether we want to admit it or not, it's harder to get around, and it's harder, it's cold outside today, that has an effect on somebody who is older than a child or a middle-aged adult. So there are more sensitive barriers for an older adult, but there are ways to combat that as well, and more non-traditional ways of being socially connected to the technology piece. There's so much research out there about older adults and anybody really utilizing technology to get or stay socially connected. And I think, Lizette, you may have mentioned it in your research or the article that I read about how going, one of the older adults that you interviewed, she goes on a monthly or weekly Zoom call, a video conference with her family just to stay connected. So while there are some barriers, there are some ways to combat those things as well.
Yeah, let me, before I send it back to Lizette. Let me mention we asked members of our texting group to write in if they have experience with this. And we heard from Beth in Champaign, who said technology, i.e. the internet, has helped me a lot, especially during the pandemic. I went looking to connect with people in a fandom, and after some trial and error, have found a group of friends I communicate with daily. I know this is not an option for many folks who are lonely. It is not always easy to navigate technology as an older or cognitively impaired person, but those who blame technology for loneliness ignore its capacity to connect people across geographical barriers. Emily, I gather that you feel there's a lot of wisdom there. Talk about you mentioned the Zoom. What other sorts of technology have people taken up to deal with this?
So Beth, thank you. You are a living example of what we're talking about. I would also say technology can be a barrier if you know nothing about it, if you just know enough to be dangerous, right? So I think the first step would be is just trying out technology, whether it be the texting or the email, whatever it may be. But when we think about technology and preventing social isolation, preventing that feeling of being lonely, it's the texting and the email, phone calls, the Facebook Messenger, online chatting, or we can get way more into it with, there's even research out there with virtual reality headsets, those big like glasses things, if you can imagine those, that have shown that people can feel more socially connected in those virtual reality spheres. So I think at the lower level, we can think of the basic technologies like the calling, the texting, instant messaging. And then a little bit higher is those virtual reality headsets and things like that.
Lizette, one of the things that Beth also mentioned in her text message is the pandemic. And I wonder if you still see after effects and how older adults in particular are still dealing with that isolation that so many of us faced during COVID.
Yeah. The pandemic created a huge, almost a big social shift. And I think that we're still coming out of that, that there's a dawning recognition that as wonderful as technology is, and it helped us overcome quite a bit during the pandemic, it's really a poor substitute for the face-to-face interactions. Human beings are multisensory, and, the technology works well in conjunction, but it can't be a substitute for those face-to-face interactions.
I agree with you.
And that is, I think, what people oftentimes lose sight of. They're like, okay, the first thing we're going to turn to is this shiny new thing called the technology. And it's easy. But there's a lot of older adults where they have fine motor skill problems. It's very hard to navigate a phone when your fingers have arthritis or your vision goes, which is very common. And you don't necessarily have contact with peer groups who may or may not be online. There is a way for us to sort of as a society think about the value that comes from even casual interactions. There's a growing literature that talks about the importance of weak links, which is sort of the coffee clutching. You used to go to the coffee and they used to know you and you'd order a coffee. And those brief interactions create a sense of belonging in a community. When you walk down the street and you see somebody walking their dog and you know the name of the dog, those kinds of interactions are make a difference for people to feel connected and not feel so lonely. They're not deep and they're not anything monumental, but they are the kinds of things that we have overlooked, especially in the context of the pandemic, how important and how much we lost in that period of time. And I think as we're still kind of getting out of that framework, it requires us that despite the fact that we have this wonderful technology, that we're still human and we require things that are very primitive, like touch and smell and which is not what technology can necessarily convey very easily.
Do the sort of political divides that people feel deeply in America now also contribute to this idea of, lacking or feeling like we don't have that same connection with our fellow humans that we might, you mentioned the dog walking down the street, for example.
Oh my God. Even if you go to the store, you go to the store and it's not uncommon to see if the workers have a moment, they're on their phones. So there's a lack of even eye contact that happens for people. You know, you're waiting online, and what used to be an opportunity for people to have interactions, they're immersed in their universe of whatever's in that shiny little phone that they're dealing with. And so it's had a huge impact on broader society, and in particular for older adults, because they grew up in a generation where that's not, you know, we didn't have access to these phones. These are really new things that have transpired over the last 25 years. And so you have a generation of people who came of age in a context that's very different. And so, yes, there is a huge generational divide. You know, even the use of the QR codes, you know, if you imagine if you were an older adult and you're going to the healthcare center and you're required to use a QR code, you're required to have a cell phone. These are all things that create barriers to access even just basic services if you are a person from a generation that did not use that.
If you're just joining us, it's the 21st Show. Our topic for the hour today is loneliness and friendships. We're talking about it for the first part of the show through the lens of recent research. It looks at the friendships older adults have and the difference that can make in their health. We originally had this program out in December with Lizette Piedra, a professor at the U of I Urbana-Champaign and the author of that research, and Emily Harmon. She's a family life educator for the U of I Extension in Champaign. We're going to keep this discussion going after a short break, and later in the hour, we'll talk about loneliness and what we can do about it. One more note. Earlier, you heard a few messages we got from our texting group when we originally had that conversation. If you want to join, you can do that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our topic today is loneliness and friendship. Right now, we're talking about recent research that looks at friendships of older adults and the difference that makes in their health. I want to share a couple of text messages we got when we originally had this conversation back in December. Lloyd in Danville said, "I do not in any way feel lonely. At 71, I still hunt, fish, and enjoy live music in and around the Midwest. I'm fortunate to have a spouse as well." Then there's Wendella in Rock City, who told us, "I'm a 71-year-old woman who's been widowed within the last year, after 46 years in a relationship. I believe I do get lonely. I wouldn't say it's chronically lonely, but maybe lonesome is a word. Living in rural northwest Illinois doesn't help because I can't drive at night, and there's just not much happening here, and I really don't have many friends here. I always find it interesting when I think about how Medicare doesn't pay for things like hearing aids or eyeglasses, which, if I'm not mistaken, are big contributors to older people's loneliness. Loneliness and isolation comes when you can't hear people or see things." Wendella, sorry to hear that. Thanks for your message. Lizette Piedra was an author on the research we're talking about. She's a professor at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. Also with us for this conversation was Emily Harmon, family life educator at the U of I Extension in Champaign. Again, this program's on tape, so no calls, but you can join our texting group, share your thoughts for future conversations, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Lizette, we often talk about older adults being set in their ways, right? And yet, according to your research, that's not always the case when it comes to friendships. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah, I would say that's a huge myth. I mean, older adults, there are certain habits and ways of being that probably we all get set in our ways. But I think that there's the research is there's a huge amount of reason to be optimistic that people can continue to grow and evolve and change. And your first caller is a really great example of that. It's you take on new hobbies, you do new things. We're in an era where it's pretty unprecedented. We've never had a population, a majority of the population, live so long. And so as we live, you know, we have a growing number of older adults, and that's becoming increasingly more older adults in our society than young people. What it means to become an older adult is very different than what it meant 40, 50 years ago. And so there, you know, and one of the places in which is becoming more and more apparent is that the importance that social connections have, and even intergenerational connections, connections with grandchildren, with younger people, with even, you know, with people throughout, with different people, and even the role of pets, you know, and having connections with other creatures. Having connections seems to make a viable difference for people in terms of their mental health and their physical well-being.
Emily, how do you take this kind of work done by researchers like Lizette and then translate that into something meaningful for the community as you're doing your work?
So Lizette and many other professors and researchers like herself are the living example of the foundation of what we do. So what the research that Lizette is doing, I'm actually sitting here taking notes, hearing her talk. I'm translating that to make it usable for my community members. So Lizette is talking about how basically as people get older, they can become more socially isolated and feel that loneliness. She's doing the research behind it, looking at all of the different people, things, and their habits, the trends. And I am taking that and just trying to make that usable for my community members to say, like, hey, here's some research behind why social isolation is so prevalent with older adults and, I mean, the world in general. And here are some barriers, but here are some things that we can do that you can make the choice that is best for your life to help yourself not feel so lonely or to prevent that social isolation. So the research Lizette does, I am just taking that and just making it usable for our community members so they can be empowered to make the best decision for their life.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Roy calling from Princeton. Roy, thank you for calling in.
Hey, well, the speakers have touched on it, but I'm also curious about what the connection would be for not just human to human, but human to non-human being. And I heard them mention pets. How does that figure into the dealing with loneliness?
All right. Thank you for the question, Roy. And maybe, Lizette, I'll send that to you first.
Okay, thank you. We need things to take care of, and they get us out of our shells. For those who have dogs, they have to walk them and care for them. And you form a relationship in the same way you form a relationship with another person. You form a relationship with a creature, whether it's a cat or a dog. And it could even be... you know, whatever gets you outside yourself and gives you a sense of being connected to something. Obviously, the more diverse and enriched your social network so that it's not just a pet, you know, but it's, you know, part of a larger constellation of things, that would be better for, you know, that's actually better for us. But I think that the big take-home message is that, you know, we don't outgrow our need for others. If anything, that connection becomes more essential as we age, and that connection, the more diverse it is also very helpful to us.
Yeah, I would also like to say that we are actually, that has came up in our research with our needs with our community that Extension works with. People want to learn more about the companionship between adults and pets, or older adults and pets. And one of the things is, Lizette highlighted most of it, but it gives that person a sense of purpose. Just to say, like, oh, I gotta get out of bed to feed Lucy this morning, or we need to go on a walk. So it's that purpose part too, when she said you need to have that diverse network, but having that pet and making sure that you can have the pet, that your home is fit, stable, all the things, But having that pet can give you a sense of purpose.
Lizette, what about artificial intelligence, chatbots? Some people are turning there for companionship now, for better and for worse in some cases. What do you think of that?
I think I've said this before. It's like they're okay substitutes for if you already have a network and you have already people in your life and you're using a chatbot to kind of fill voids, that's great. If it's the only thing you have, it's probably better than nothing. But remember, we are multisensory. You know, I mean, there's one thing to like somebody and send a message electronically. It's another thing to have someone call you or pay you a visit or go for a walk with someone. You know, we are multisensory, and the aspects of touch and sound and smell is really not what a chat box can replicate, although it is probably better than nothing. We don't we need connection, but we also need diverse connections, you know, and we need to be realistic that we're human and human beings are multisensory. And so any kind of social connections that are devoid of that, I think, becomes very anemic. It's sort of like the junk food of, you know, connections. It's like it works, you know, if you're starving, you know, it'll give you the calories. But if you really want a healthy, robust, and reap the benefits, you really need something that's diverse and multifaceted.
Lizette Piedra is a professor in social work as well as Latina and Latino studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Emily Harmon is family life educator with University of Illinois Extension. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
us.
Let me say it's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking for the hour today about friendships, loneliness, and health, from the difference it makes for us to be connected with other people to what we can do to make ourselves less lonely. Loneliness in particular is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the hour. It's something that affects many of us, and the isolation can have effects beyond just our mental health. Nell Comprenol studies loneliness and social connectedness in her work as a senior research scientist with The Bridge at NORC at the University of Chicago. NORC is short for the National Opinion Research Center. Nell, welcome to the 21st show.
Happy to be here.
And Sarah Schroeders is a therapist at Stillwaters Counseling in Springfield. She also works as a counselor through Illinois' Department of Human Services. Sarah, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Nell Comprenol with NORC, I'm going to start with you and let's set a baseline. What is loneliness? How do you define it?
I'm so happy you asked that. It is just taking a step back after this rich discussion so far. There is kind of a leading definition or way of thinking about it related to the cognitive discrepancy perspective, which really holds on to the fact that there is, while they're related, social isolation and loneliness are quite distinct, in that social isolation can be thought of as the objective social relationship surrounding an individual. Whereas loneliness then is that perceived social isolation. So, kind of this discrepancy between one's actual and achieved social relationships with what it is they're actually looking for or needing. And so, kind of thinking about this discrepancy and putting it into this, I think Lizette got at this quite nicely. My colleague at NORC, Louise Hawkley, and her University of Chicago colleagues, Cassiopo, have this wonderful theory on the evolutionary theory of loneliness, which really posits that at our core, and what kind of sets us apart from other mammals, is really this social, we are social creatures that need safe and secure social environment to survive and thrive. And so thinking about that, loneliness, as kind of our listeners and this conversation has gotten to, is it's an evolved, normal, natural experience, kind of like hunger. And so we've evolved as these social beings where loneliness acts as a prompt or a trigger to have us take a step back and reevaluate our social environment. What is it about it that is not helping us to survive and thrive? And so thinking about, again, this kind of activation piece. And so, you know, when we talk about what we can do or who's at increased risk, we can think about ways then to change our social environment. And so individuals may be better or not as good at then kind of being able to control it. There's kind of this psychosocial component where if you are unable then to change your social environment, you may experience this sort of hypervigilance with loneliness where it kind of increases your maladaptive responses. And so you might then start to seek social relationships or interactions less often. It increases cortisol levels. And so kind of this chronic stressors then might lead into not just adverse health outcomes, but kind of coincide with some of these maladaptive responses where paradoxically you are seeking out social relationships less often, kind of leading to this loneliness feedback loop.
Yeah, kind of a spiral there. You know, I'm intrigued, right. Sarah. I'm intrigued, Sarah, by something that, Nell mentioned about sort of the difference between, you know, actually being able to measure sort of social isolation and loneliness being the perception, right? And there's this band, people can look this up, called Chatham County Line. I saw them perform in Springfield years ago, and they had a song called Alone in New York, right? And it's this idea that you can be lonely in a crowd. So, Sarah, what are some of the ways that, loneliness manifests in our lives?
Sure, absolutely. So when it comes to loneliness, I look at, especially during the adolescent ages, because that is the age group that I primarily work with, 14 through like 27. So when I'm looking at loneliness, I look at some of the risk factors that they may exhibit due to that loneliness. So some of the risk factors that they are are an increased risk for smoking, drug use, misuse of alcohol, or developing process addictions. And so when individuals express loneliness, those are some of the things that we kind of look at to explore to see if those are any things that they experience. Additionally, kind of going on the note that Nell explained, when we're looking at social isolation, it does become kind of what I like to describe to people, a snake that kind of eats itself. You do develop that hypervigilance of your surroundings, and you start to view the outside world, so to speak, as a social threat, which then increases cortisol levels, which then makes you more hypervigilant and makes that feeling of the social world outside being more and more scary. And so that is when we get into the realm of maybe dissociative disorders, and sometimes even a more complex level of dissociative disorder where individuals may experience depersonalization or derealization. So they might experience a feeling of being disconnected from themselves and others, not just emotionally, but physically. And they might have an altered sense of perception because of that.
All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. This is the 21st show. We're talking for the hour today about friendships, loneliness, and health, from the difference it makes for us to be connected with other people to what we can do to make ourselves less lonely. We originally talked about this on the program back in December, and for the last part of the show, we spoke about it in a more practical way. My guests were Sarah Schroeder, a therapist at Stillwaters Counseling in Springfield, and Nell Compernoll, who studies loneliness and social connectedness in her work as a senior research scientist with The Bridge at NORC, the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Again, we're not taking calls today because our program is on tape, but you can let us know what you think about this or anything else we've talked about on the program. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. As I've been mentioning, you can join our texting group. You do that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. That's TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. You can find all of this and more, including our voicemail line and links to our past shows, at 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. All right, more on loneliness after a short break. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about what's been described as an epidemic of loneliness in America, from how we feel loneliness to what's driving those feelings and what we can do about them. More listener text messages. Tony in Champaign said, "I've experienced loneliness as a sort of stress, though not in a very long while. I don't think social media would have been any help. I've always found communing with nature much more effective." Our guests for this part of the show are Sarah Schroeder, a therapist in Springfield, and research scientist Nell Compernol. We originally spoke with them back in December. Because of that, no calls today, but you can share your thoughts with us. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. Sarah, in your experience, how do people do at sort of recognizing when they are lonely?
In the cases that I've worked, or I guess in the settings that I've worked with individuals, I haven't really had individuals come expressing loneliness. Typically, they come expressing the mental health complexities they have due to that loneliness. Just kind of like an interesting fact is that most individuals before the age of 24, 75% of mental health issues will emerge by that age. And so often I will have adolescents that come in expressing their anxieties or expressing some of their complexities in regards to feelings of dissociative disorders, maybe feeling not quite like themselves, maybe feeling like they are unattached from their bodies. Some will express a feeling of kind of like they're floating, or some may express a feeling that they are like an NPC in a video game, just kind of like going through life, but not actually like feeling as though they're living it or experiencing it. So then we have to take a step back and kind of understand, where did that feeling come from? Sometimes it can be trauma, sometimes it can be other instances, but in the realm of what I've been seeing lately, a lot of it comes from feelings of isolation, feelings of loneliness, which impact them vastly. And in addition to any dissociative features, some may experience, like I mentioned earlier, anxieties or even people-pleasing features. So typically they'll come with those, I don't want to say complaints, but for lack of better words, complaints of those symptoms. And then we have to kind of take a look back and dissect, where did these come from? And often loneliness and isolation are a source, or at least one of those sources, for individuals.
Nell, there was an APA, American Psychological Association study, that found or estimated half of U.S. adults say they lack companionship or are isolated from others, at least some of the time. What are some of the factors behind that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I do think prevalence kind of varies across, but it is true in that a growing number of American adults are reporting feelings or experiences with loneliness. And part of that was due to kind of what we had discussed earlier, and that is just natural changes to one's kind of social relationships, whether it is, you know, trends over time or with age. We are less likely to be married. We are less likely to stay married. We are more likely than at any other time to live alone. And we discussed this earlier, but kind of as we age, our mobility declines. And so again, that changes our ability to, as that wonderful listener noted, go outside, go into nature, or as Lizette talked earlier, kind of go and walk around the neighborhood and experience spontaneous social interactions. And so there's kind of larger trends as we kind of over time in how we structure our social lives. I think there is also an element that we have not recovered fully from the pandemic, in that we got very used to staying home. And, you know, whether it was interacting virtually, we've talked a lot about social media. And while social media and digital interactions have really serve a purpose and provide value, they do not replace that in-person feelings of social connection.
You know, a couple of messages from listeners that I think are on point with that. One is from Jesse in Mattoon, who says, loneliness is what makes us Americans lately. Too politically charged to have any real conversation with anyone. My heart breaks for our kids. And then another person who asked to remain anonymous said, I'm an introvert, love to spend time alone. It's the easy default for me. Yet I also feel quite forlorn at times. I miss close relatives that I haven't seen since COVID. I take part in community groups, but never quite make it to the friend level. Is social isolation the root of our evils today in America? When I think of all the folks that are marginalized and alone, I feel like I'm part of the problem. Thank you for sharing that message. Nell, where do you land in terms of the cause and effect relationship here?
That's tricky. I do think, again, there's larger social patterns that are changing. I do think there's some nice research that has kind of identified key dimensions of loneliness that could help us understand some of these broader social trends and then kind of how that relates to our feelings of social isolation. And they all kind of subscribe to providing or feeling that you provide social value across these dimensions. So one is in the intimate realm. So kind of, do you provide social value as an individual? This is oftentimes captured in marital relationships or with a romantic partner. The second is similar, but with dyadic relationships. Your listener who called in had a nice note on kind of getting at that deeper friendship level. So the relational dimension is really related to number of family and friendships of quality. And this third one is really interesting. And I think the listeners and everyone is getting to this quite nicely. And this is a collective dimension. So really whether an individual feels a collective identity or belonging to a group. And I do think that kind of our polarizing political climate of today and kind of our individualistic attitudes in general have kind of then exacerbated since the pandemic of feeling like, you know, we may not belong to this broader collective society. We may distrust some of these interactions more often than we used to. And it is kind of harder to find something that you feel a part of.
Sarah, I want to share another message from a listener. This is from Christopher in Brimfield. When we asked about loneliness, he mentioned, it's an epidemic among men especially. There have been books written about this lately. What do you think of that? Do you see this in your work?
I do see this in my work. I don't get as many male clients coming in as I do female clients. But in the male clients that I do get, I more often than not have them express feelings of loneliness. Some of them do express some of their behaviors shift or have expressed shifts in their behavior. So for example, maybe switching to a more sedentary lifestyle, having jobs or hobbies that are sedentary, getting out, doing less, touching less surfaces, less objects, just kind of in general, being isolated. And that does play an impact on our mental health. That does play an impact on our wellness. And just as mentioned before, we are multisensory people. So when we do isolate and we're not getting those sensory experiences, we are underutilizing parts of our brain, and that overall can impact our mental and emotional wellness in many ways.
I want to share a counterpoint to that idea of the male loneliness epidemic. This is from Christina in Springfield, who says, in response to our prompt in the text messaging group, I feel like this is just an extension of the conversation around the manufactured male loneliness epidemic, in quotes. People aren't lonely. They're traumatized, overworked, underpaid. They're socialized badly, anti-socialized, really, due to hyper-individualism and probably partially propelled by technology. And in a similar vein, John in Rockford writes, is it an epidemic only of loneliness, or is it also an epidemic of alienation? Eric Fromm, in his 1955 book, The Sane Society, wrote at length about the latter, which he described as an almost unavoidable disease of the citizenry of any modern industrial capitalist society. Nell, what do you think of those critiques of the idea of the male loneliness epidemic?
Those were very, very thoughtful contributions to this discussion. I would like to thank them for that. And For one, I would say that when it comes to an epidemic, I would say that the data do support more of an epidemic of social isolation. Loneliness has kind of been common for quite some time. Again, following that U-shaped curve across the life course, we have somewhat recovered to pre-pandemic times, but it is really a social isolation story with, of course, loneliness consequences. When it comes to gender differences, it is interesting. I should just note that we find some interesting measurement discrepancies, and that is that men tend to report loneliness when loneliness as a word is not included in the survey item. And so they actually will come up in the data as have been experiencing more loneliness when you ask about it using certain words, whether it is lacking companionship or feeling left out. Whereas women report higher rates when you do include loneliness in the stem, which is interesting. I think over time, there is a very, very complicated story that a lot of pieces are part of this. One is that men's social lives do tend to revolve more around their wives in later life than do women's. And that is part of it if a marriage dissolves. I completely agree with the listener that there are the workplace has changed. And so retirement has certain implications for men and their partners and women as they kind of change their employment status. But I do think that the story remains quite true and that across these intimate, relational, and collective dimensions of loneliness, men and women both, and across the age categories, we are feeling it in new ways and because of new reasons.
We're coming to the end of our time together. I do want to take a moment, though, to ask, sort of from a practical standpoint, Sarah, and maybe just about a minute, minute and a half, given everything we've talked about, how do you help people deal with loneliness and isolation?
Sure, absolutely. Usually the first step is for me to help them identify what their I guess reasoning for the isolation is. Is it a psychological reason? Is it social? Is it a neurocognitive driven factor? Is it an issue between with the relationship with their community? Identifying why they may be isolated or feel isolated or self-isolating. And then we incorporate different skills to try to help alleviate that and make steps to either reintegrate into the community or and or also address some of the other mental health needs that accompany what they may be experiencing, for example, anxiety or depersonalization. I like to use a multisensory approach in my practice, including somatic work. I found that to be very beneficial for individuals that are experiencing loneliness to a level where they are having mental health issues stemming from it. And so I have found that somatic and polyvagal theory have been very beneficial, as well as cognitive behavior therapy strategies for identifying the why and working on ways to make changes to reintegrate back into the community and no longer feel lonely or no longer self-isolate.
Sarah Schroeder is a therapist with Stillwaters Counseling. Nell Comprenol is a senior research scientist with The Bridge at NORC at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Again, we originally talked about loneliness on the program back in December. That is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the language we use every day evolves slowly over time, but the linguist Adam Alexic, known online as the Etymology Nerd, says the rise of the internet and short-form video is accelerating that. All this is the subject of his book, Algospeak. It's coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.